All right, everybody, welcome to the Living with Fire panel. I'm Amy Quinton with Capital Public Radio, and wanted to start off just by making a few little observations. In 2015, wildfires burned more than 10 million acres, and federal spending on fighting these fires exceeded more than $2 billion. Last year, the number of wildfires in Northern California, the Northwest, Alaska, and the Northern Rockies exceeded their 10-year average. Wildfires destroyed more than 2,600 homes nationwide. A little more than 2,000 of those were here in California. California has been in a state of emergency since I moved here in 2012 because of wildfires. So what's going on? How much of this is a bad drought or climate change or a poorly managed forest or too many people living where they shouldn't? Is it getting worse? In order to truly understand why wildfires occur where they do and whether they're different than the normal and what's fueling them, we have to understand some science. And how can we further our reporting on forest wildfire policy beyond a two-sided debate between those who believe no tree or shrub should be touched and those who believe we can log our way out of future wildfires? And how can we as journalists cover this story better? And hopefully we will be able to answer all of those questions. Poorly, perhaps, but we're going to get to them. Let me introduce my panelists. First of all, Hugh Safford on the far end here is a regional ecologist for the U.S. Forest Service's Pacific Southwest region and an adjunct faculty member in the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at UC Davis. Then we have John Keeley. He's a senior research ecologist with USGS, and he's stationed in Sequoia National Park. He's also a professor at UCLA, and much of his research, he's also one of the leading experts in Southern California wildfires. And then we have Leroy Westerling here. He's an associate professor of management at UC Merced. His research has focused on climate change impacts on wildfire and paleo reconstructions of climate-wildfire interactions, which I don't even know what that means. So, and then we have Ed Smith. He's an ecologist with the Nature Conservancy and is working to conserve and improve the health and resilience of forests, meadows, and riparian communities here in the Sierra Nevada. And welcome to you all. Thanks for coming here. I guess, you know, I sort of preface this with how bad everything is, but is it really? I mean, are we seeing more intense or you know, a longer season of wildfires? And Leroy, maybe you want to start with this because I know you've done a lot of research recently on that.
Sure. So, yeah, we are getting a lot more fire than we have in recent decades. Of course, if you look at what was going on here, say, 100, 150 years ago, there was a lot of more fire even, but in most of the 20th century it was less because of fire suppression and land use changes, and now we have rapid increases that are linked to climate, and it's not necessarily the case that just because we're burning more now it's the same, getting to be more like the fire we had 150 years ago or 100 years ago. It may be different, have different characteristics in terms of the severity and where you're getting the increases in fire.
So are we having more intense fires?
Certainly here in California and the Southwest, we've seen that. And so we've seen increases in fire severity in terms of high-severity burn patches. We've seen really dramatic increases in parts of the West in total area burned in large fires and forests around the West. Rockies, we're looking at more like 3,000% increases in the
3,000.
Yeah, Northwest 5,000 since the 70s and early 80s when it was particularly low, and the number of really large fires have increased substantially as well.
So, and John, I wanted to talk to you a bit because I think it's important to point out, you know, how fires burn really, I mean, it depends on weather conditions, of course, but it also varies depending on the type of vegetation, elevation, where the fire is. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think probably the most important thing to keep in mind when talking about fire in California is California has the largest latitudinal extent of any state in the West. And as a result, you can't just talk about fire in California because fires in the northern part of the state are often very different than fires in the southern part of the state. And largely that's due to the fact that the landscapes are different. The vegetation ecosystems are very different. And much of what I've done in the past has involved non-forested shrublands, which is what dominates the southern half of the state. And the situation with fire in shrublands is very different than it is in forests. In forests, you can make a case that fire intensity and severity has increased in recent decades, and it's seen in the fact that historically fires would tend to burn in the understory. Less often you would have crowning where the entire canopy is taken out. Today we're seeing more and more of that, and so you potentially could make a case that intensity or severity may be increasing in forested situations. In shrublands, you can't make that case at all. We've always had high-intensity shrubland fires, and there's no evidence at all that intensity has been increasing in the southern part of the state. There's also no evidence that fire size or even the amount of area burned has necessarily increased. The what has changed in the last several decades, though, is the numbers of large fires. We've had really huge fires historically in Southern California, hundreds of thousands of acres. Today, we have fires that size. They're not anomalous, but what is anomalous is the frequency, and we're getting more and more of them, and particularly in the last decade. And this seems to be tied to an extraordinary drought that the southern part of the state has been in. In fact, if you look at the average decadal drought index for the southern half of the state, we've technically been in a drought for the last five decades. And part of the problem when you have droughts like that in shrubland systems is you get dieback of the vegetation. So you get a lot of fine dead fuels in the canopy of the vegetation. And that plays a big role in promoting the size of fires, because one of the big determinants of fire size is whether or not embers that blow ahead of the fire front start fires. And they're dependent on landing on dead vegetation. And so the more drought we have, the more dead fuels we accumulate in the canopy, and that increases the possibility of spot fires and increasing the size of those fires. And the important thing about droughts is it has a legacy effect, so that this year we have not been in nearly as severe a drought as in the past couple years, but that legacy of dead fuels is still there. And so there is still the potential for big fire events, even in years where you don't have abnormally dry conditions.
So I remember hearing that if we do get a little bit of rain in some of these environments, then you have new growth, and then by the summertime, by the time things grow out, you actually have more fuel on the ground to burn.
Well, that depends on the type of the fuels in the system. If you are in an ecosystem where most of the fuels are herbaceous surface fuels like grasslands, savannas, then yes, high rainfall is going to increase the fuel load and will increase the extent of fire. We saw it, for example, in the Sierra Nevada in the last few years. We've had severe droughts and really severe fires in the montane system, but those are systems driven by dead surface fuels of leaves and branches. In the foothills, we had very little fire, and that was largely because the drought eliminated the herbaceous fuels in the foothills. So when we have a high rainfall year, like in the Sierra Nevada, we had high rainfall this year. We got a lot of herbaceous growth, and we potentially could have a big fire year next year in the foothills.
Hugh, you want to chime in here in terms of what we're seeing? Are you falling asleep back there? I know, you know, after lunch, people...
No, I'm not falling asleep. No, so I would, yeah, a couple of things I'd like to build on. What John noted is really important, that I think that people can tend to think of sort of the California fire problem, if you will, and there's a bunch of different issues in California fire. And John works a lot in Southern California chaparral. I tend to work more in forested systems in the north. And I think one of the overwhelmingly important things to realize about California is that we live in a Mediterranean climate system here. And it's pretty difficult, particularly if you're trying to compare patterns of things that are going on in British Columbia or Alaska or the Northern Rockies or the wetter parts of the Pacific Northwest, to compare those patterns to what we see here, because we have a 4 to 6 month drought every single year in this state. And so when you talk about sort of this herbaceous issue, we've got really dry herbaceous fuels pretty much every summer, as long as you've got enough precipitation to grow them in the winter. And so I know Scott Stevens calls California like the Pyro State or something. What does he call it? Something like that. Pyro State, yeah, or whatever. But, I mean, the point is essentially that we have I grew up in Montana, and Montana has a flat hydrograph. Okay, basically, you get the same amount of precipitation through the whole year. But in California, once you hit May, whoever it is upstairs there turns that button off, and until October, you're not going to see much more. And so we have the kind of drought here every single year that Montana fears it might have every 100 or 150 or 200 years. So it's a very, very different system with respect to a lot of things, the way ecosystems function, the way water moves through the system, and the way that fire moves through the system as well. And yeah, I don't know what else to say with respect to your question. John did a really nice job of hitting some of the highlights.
So what do we expect? Did you want to say something?
I just wanted to touch on one thing that people may not be aware of, and that's that Leroy talked about how fire was across the landscape in the forested systems pre-contact time, and this is starting, you know, from thousands of years ago up until about 1850. And I just think it's important to recognize that fire is such an important part of these forested landscapes that ran through. It's hard to think of low-severity fire or fire that doesn't really do any damage, but it's part of the system, these forested systems that has adapted with thick bark, serotonous cones that release seeds when they burn, a lot of different mechanisms to deal with low-severity fire that just burns through and kind of cleans up the litter on the ground, on the soil, and recycles nutrients, and that's been missing from the system for such a long time that now we have this accumulation of fuels and the ladder of fuels that carries fires up into the tops of trees, that is a very, you know, the characteristics of fire that are very different from what our systems have evolved with for thousands of years. So,
yeah, and I wanted to get into kind of the questions of, I mean, that brings up management and how we deal with this. I mean, this fire is a natural part of the ecosystem, so how do we bring that back? People talk about prescribed fires, but that may not be the best thing to do in all ecosystems and all different types of environment, forested versus non-forested, that sort of thing. So what are your thoughts on that in terms of management, what we should be doing and what we're not doing enough of?
Go ahead, you can go first.
So when I was mentioning the really large increases, those were in ecosystems that are very different from what we have in California. And so they have such large increases, like the Northern Rockies, for example, or Greater Yellowstone and parts of the Northwest, because they didn't burn that much before. And so you have their systems where a climate was the main constraint on burning, but they were close in different places at different degrees of closeness to thresholds where once you warm it up enough, and we've done that in some places now, that you start lifting that constraint. And so eventually the constraint on burning there is the availability of continuous fuel layer to carry the fire and not climate keeping the fuels wet anymore. Now here in California, like we're saying, it's much drier. And you have this long summer drought every year. And so the increases here have been much less than other parts of the West. And one of the reasons that we're so cognizant of the increase, even though it is less, is because we have a lot of people living around it. And so you have these issues of the footprint of development and how you manage the fuels. But in general, in California, most of the people are living with their houses in the midst of ecosystems that are not that sensitive to climate change. And most of the forest ecosystems that are most sensitive to climate change in California are on public lands and somewhat distinct. So really you got multiple problems in the state, how you manage human ignitions in say, the chaparral, where maybe you're burning too much, too often, because of additional human ignitions. Most of the property risk is due to how the pattern of development, not necessarily climate change. And most of the climate change effects are up on federal lands in the Sierras.
Is that because of the higher elevation?
There's a higher elevation, so they have more snow, cooler winters, and so they're more sensitive to warming and shifting and timing of warm up in the spring and things like that. So very distinct problems, actually. And they overlap, you know, on the edges, but they're really different from each other.
You want to chime in on that?
You'll need to repeat your question.
Well, I started talking about some of the solutions, some of the management solutions to dealing with fire, but fire, of course, is a natural part of at least the Sierra Nevada. what are your thoughts? I mean, you know, the Forest Service clearly hasn't done enough prescribed burning. We have a buildup of fuels. How do we get fire back into that landscape?
Is that a challenge? I'm work for the Forest Service.
I know.
No one has done enough prescribed fire. But prescribed fire is not going to get us out of this problem. There's no way. Basically, to try to be as unbiased as I can, most Western ecosystems that can generate fuel see fire at some interval, right? And in a lot of California ecosystems, fire was relatively common. But mind you, not nearly as common in some systems as in others. And John gave a great example of chaparral ecosystems where if you take humans out of the equation, there almost isn't a natural ignition source except along the eastern edge near the desert where you get some lightning, right? But when you work your way into these sort of, montane, we might call them forests, the things where I think most of us are cognizant of, quote-unquote, the fire problem, these were systems that were burning an ungodly amount, enough that a lot of the records of the early settlers and miners, et cetera, are full of references to how much smoke there was often in the air and how they may not have very often seen scenes like we have seen out at the end of the Rim fire with a lot of dead trees, but they were seeing dead trees and they were seeing a lot of fire scarring on the bases of trees. And people are fearful of fire, and it's obvious why. But I just wanted to make just to put this in context so you understand the kind of forest that people walked into in the beginning of the 20th century that was shaped by all of this fire. And because I think then we can talk about why it's so difficult to introduce fire into these systems today. Not just logistically difficult, but politically difficult in a lot of cases as well, and financially. But when your first foresters walk into the Sierra Nevada in late 1800s, early 1900s, they notice four or five things. One is the trees are the biggest things they've ever seen in their lives. It takes multiple people holding hands to go around a lot of the trees that they're seeing, and they've never seen anything like it. Second one is the forest is very open. You can read John Muir or anyone you want. It's amazing. They could take a horse and ride in almost any direction through a lot of the landscape. Now, that is a gross generalization, but there was a lot of really open forest. It was mostly pine species, and pine species are not climax species. They're early cereal species. It made no sense to them. That species that you'd normally find in systems not that long after a disturbance were very large and dominating the ecosystem. And then finally, there was an amazing amount of fire in on the ground all the time, and as a result, they didn't see any seedlings of anything. You read Lyberg, you read Sudworth, you read any of these guys, and these are the early foresters, wrote tomes on this stuff. And they're thinking, okay, if we're going to be cutting these really big trees, because we are, because we need to build railroads and towns and ports and run mines, etc., then where is the regeneration going to come from that's going to replace these big trees? Oh, we got it. We cut the trees, we stopped the fire, problem solved. So what you've done now is defined the next 100 years of management since then. Right? It was focused on stopping fire, managing forests. So now we've got systems that are so full of fuel that we're scared to reintroduce fire into them. And I will say, I want to make this really clear, that there are places in the Sierra Nevada and elsewhere in the western U.S. where people had some serious guts 40 years ago. And as the science started to show really clearly that the lack of fire was a really big and critical ecological issue, that the only way in many parts of the some parts of the landscape, I shouldn't say many, to counteract the negative outcomes of not having the fire in the landscape was to reintroduce fire itself. And the places that did it are like Yosemite, Sequoia Kings Canyon, a lot of the national park units in the western U.S. now, and some Forest Service units as well. And it has been amazingly successful. I mean, I think all of us, well, I can't speak for everyone, but everyone I know sees what went on in Yosemite as being just an absolutely unbelievable, giant landscape-level experiment, which has turned out to be almost nothing but positive. Now, you move to the Forest Service landscape, it's a different landscape. These were lands that were used, right? There was a lot of cutting that went on, a lot of settlement that went on. We have the roads and the towns and the power lines and all that stuff in our landscapes. Politically, way more difficult to pull this kind of work off. It does happen in some landscapes, but so Amy, when I'm talking about fire, though, I'm talking about lightning ignited fire, like a wildfire kind of thing. So then you get to the question of prescribed fire, and what it comes down to is, can you actually do enough prescribed fire when all you can burn is a few hundred acres at a shot to solve a problem that's probably a couple hundred thousand acres worth of problem every summer? And the answer is no. You can use it strategically along with vegetation management, which has a very important role to play, but this is a very strategic thing. So it's a conundrum, and I'm not here to provide any answers to anyone. I know that there are certain people in the public and people in the agencies who have very different, diametrically opposed opinions on how you might solve the problem. And I know all of us at this table have some of our own opinions about that as well. So I would invite them to tell us.
Hasn't the drought sort of taken care of some of it for us?
Well, I don't know if it's taken care of it.
But we have a lot fewer live trees now.
Yeah, what to do with the dead trees?
One of the things that we need to keep in mind, relative to what I said early on about the large latitudinal gradient in the state, is this is the Northern California-centric view of the role of prescribed burning, and it's a very different situation in the southern half of the state. And a good paper for any of you to look at is one that Hugh did along with co-author Van Water, 2014. I think if you just Google that, you'll find an excellent summary of the fact that California has two different fire regimes. It has the Northern California regime where we've put out fires successfully and caused fuels to accumulate. And then we have the southern half of the state where we haven't even come close to putting fires out, probably have far more fire in the last 100 years than we ever had. And part of that is driven by just topographic patterns. We don't have the big Sierra Nevada barrier in the southern half of the state, so we get these Santa Ana winds that blow through the southern part of the state, and it's under those wind conditions where you might get 50, 60 mile per hour winds under 5% relative humidity. That's where we get much of our burning take place. And when we get a fire started under those conditions, within the first 12 hours, we might burn 40,000 acres or something. It's very different when it comes to forest. I remember when I first got to Sequoia National Park a number of years ago, and we had a email that said a lightning storm came through the park, and we got 13 fires started. We should meet tomorrow to decide what to do about it. You wouldn't have that response in the southern half of the state because it's a very different situation. In short, it's been easy relative to Southern California to put fires out when they occur during lightning storms. And as a result, the agencies have been very successful in eliminating fire. And as a result, we have in many places over a century of fuel accumulation, which wouldn't have happened in the absence of these suppression policies. And so, but in the southern half of the state, we haven't had that impact at all. We haven't been able to exclude fire. We don't have an abnormal fuel accumulation. Therefore, there's very little reason to think that doing prescribed burning is going to solve any problem. Plus, due to the high density metropolitan areas that juxtapose most of these watersheds, it's just too dangerous to do. We've had too many instances where, you know, federal agencies have been sued for large sums of money because prescribed burns got out of control. In fact, I've been told that that's why we no longer call these controlled burns, because the federal agencies realized they couldn't control them. They could just prescribe them. So it's very different in the southern half of the state. We don't really need to do any prescribed burning. It doesn't mean that there isn't a need for some sort of action to modify fuels, but what we have found in the southern part of the state is the most effective thing is to focus on the interface between wildland areas and urban areas, because that's where we have our biggest concern. There are more homes lost in the southern part of the state than any other place in the world. I think in the last 10 years, we've averaged about 1,000 homes a year that have been lost from wildfires. And so the emphasis by most people in the southern part of the state is to focus any sort of treatments at the interface, and not for mainly for the purpose of trying to produce defensible space so that firefighters can go in safely and protect homes and not worry about stopping the fire.
But are local governments making that happen? I mean, are there building codes? Is that part of the picture that are we actually doing?
Well, there's a requirement in the state to have at least 100-foot clearance around your property. Now, what clearance means is kind of debatable. Most people would argue that you probably don't want to clear everything, because if you clear everything, it actually could cause worse problems. For example, when you clear everything out of an interface zone, you potentially have a greater chance of embers flying in, landing on homes. In fact, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that having trees around your house can do a lot to protect your house, simply because trees aren't going to ignite from embers, but they do catch the embers. And we don't have any good systematic data to show this, but there's anecdotal evidence that suggests having oak trees around your house could be actually very protective.
Cal Fire would not like that statement, I didn't
think. That'd be only one of many.
I want to change a little bit and sort of talk about our future and what we're seeing with climate change. I mean, what sort of impacts are we seeing at this point? I mean, can we point to climate? Because, you know, you hear the media say this, oh, climate change, drought, it's all worse and it's going to be worse. Well, are we going to see an increase in wildfires?
Let me just continue with this dichotomy between the North and the South, because it's really important when thinking about climate change. If you look at the historical fire data and you look at those years where we had really high fire activity, say in the Sierra Nevada, they're generally summers and springs where temperatures were significantly higher than in other years. The highest temperatures you see in those seasons in the Sierra Nevada are the lowest temperatures you see in Southern California every year. And as a result, we don't see any good evidence that these systems are climate limited in the southern half of the state. They appear to be ignition limited. And not just in the numbers of ignitions, because we've always had huge numbers of ignitions. It's ignitions that occur at the worst possible time under the worst conditions. But the climate every year is potentially suitable for a really catastrophic fire. And if you look at the really bad fires we've had in the last decade, and you look at the temperatures and the wind speeds that occurred during those fires, it's hard to imagine we would see any conditions in the future that are going to be much worse than what they are during those big fire events. So it's not probably the number one issue in the southern part of the state. And what I think is a better issue to focus on is not climate change, but global change, because there's a lot of things that are going to happen in the future. In Southern California, 95% of our fires are started by people, and in the next 30 years, we're going to get a 50% increase in population and maybe a 4 or 5% increase in temperature, and there's probably more reason to be concerned about the demographic changes than in the climate change. And in a way, at least for journalists, I think, this is a more positive message to be able to go to the public and say, you know, not throw up your hands and say, well, temperatures are going to get worse and we're just going to have worse fires. If you recognize that there are a lot of global changes that we can control, like population growth, that there is a more positive message of how to look at the future in terms of fires.
Anybody else want to?
Well, so he's talking primarily about coastal Southern California chaparral, right? So if you think about the forested ecosystems in California, in Northern California, in the Sierras or the Coast Ranges, in a sense, they're more sensitive to climate change because of the legacy of fire suppression. If most of the burning was occurring in surface fuels and you had this open canopy, you wouldn't really care if you tended to get a little more grass fire. So really, the reason we're having the impacts, we're starting to see the impacts that we are, is because of the combination of climate change and fire suppression. And that's really different from someplace like the Rockies, where you had a closed canopy forest that had stand-replacing fire to begin with. You don't have a lot of options. Here we do have the options. If we could somehow treat those fuels, you know, we'd be much more resilient to climate change in the state, even in our, you know, moister forests or in Northern California.
So let me sort of bring it back again, though, to some of the management that we're dealing with now. Prescribed fire is a problem for, let me talk just about forested environments. Talk to me about some of the hindrances to prescribed fire, Ed.
Okay.
Because right. you, and I want to bring you in too, because you know you're an environmental group. You like trees.
Right.
Right.
How are you dealing with this in terms of, you know, getting the message out to people that live in the WUI about fire and its benefits?
So we're also a land management group. We own a lot of land. And so I have recent experience with trying to put together a prescribed burn in California, and I'll relate some of the issues that I've come up against as far as, you know, regulatory work and trying to get ready to put in a fire. Liability concerns are a huge one. There's not a lot of operators who can, private operators who can manage a fire on a piece of land and have sufficient liability insurance to cover the potential losses of the person who lights the match and lets that fire burn, especially if you have an escape and a problem with a high-value resource off-site. So liability is a big one, and that has its cascade of problems down of people like me who want to do burning but don't want to lose their job over you know, being the one who lit that match and planned that burn. The regulatory side is complicated. You need to go through NEPA in the case of federal lands, or CEQA. That's a equivalent to National Environmental Policy Act. It's the California Environmental Quality Act for state and private lands. And it takes a lot of money and resources to run through the process of analyzing the effects of what would happen when you light the fire, and what the alternative approach of if you didn't use fire, if you used mechanical harvest or some other process to get rid of the fuels that you want to get rid of. And that's expensive and time-consuming. And then, so that's the environmental side of it. But then there's also the air quality, and that's probably one of the biggest hindrances. And it's not because we don't have enough days where smoke can get into the air and there's not enough airspace. It's a matter of lining up when you can put a prescription together, when you have the conditions that are conducive to a productive burn on the ground, controlled or prescribed, however you want to call it, that you have a problem with lining up the available days when the air quality is most conducive to moving air out of the airshed that is of concern with that prescription. So there's a mismatch, and you have plenty of days when you can burn, but it's not a safe time to reintroduce fire.
But I've also been hearing here in California that because of our drought, because of warming temperatures, you're actually getting a longer season that you could actually do more prescribed burning, because it's like warm. I've heard of prescribed burning in the wintertime.
Well, you can do prescribed burning in the wintertime if you have the staff and resources available. And the other thing is, in a place like the Sierra, where you want to have water available for suppression activities in case there's a problem, it's a challenge to manage having water during freezing temperatures. And there's just a lot of logistical details that come to play here. The other side of that, that's kind of an even bigger issue that has to do with the global change in population growth that John talked about, is we have more and more people moving into that interface between forest and urban areas. So you have more and more challenges to getting fire back on the ground when you have more people within a danger zone of where that fire might otherwise occur. So the train left the station a long time ago. We've got a lot of possibilities of things we could do, but we're not even close to catching up with the train of human habitation and population growth into these areas that need fire.
Let me just put a couple numbers on this, too, that might be of interest. I'm stationed in Sequoia National Park, and Sequoia does about 5,000 acres a year prescribed burning. And their goal is to restore natural fire regimes, which are maybe on the order of every 20 years, roughly, in those forested systems. They have 800,000 acres to manage, not all of which is forested, but burning at the rate of 5,000 acres a year is not going to get you anywhere as close to restoring a natural fire regime. A lot of what restricts that is the air quality issue and in the park. And one of the things that makes it even more difficult is it was thought for a while that maybe the best way to get fire back into the system was to use wildland fires ignited by lightning, which the park did not intentionally ignite, so they weren't prescribed burns the way we normally think of them. But the Air Quality District will force them to put those fires out as well if the air conditions aren't suitable. And so that isn't even an option. And the air quality is a huge issue. I mean, I know. I live in a community right outside the park. I know the reason why the park burns, and I hate it when they have a prescribed burn because it is really very obnoxious. And the public really doesn't have nearly the understanding of why it's being done as I might have, and they really don't like it. And they have a lot of influence on legislators who have been able to keep it under control in terms of how much burning's done. So as Hugh said, you know, we're probably, you know, not at a point where we have a good solution to how to deal with the accumulating fuels other than to just select areas. And that's what the Park Service has done. They've chosen giant sequoia groves to do much of the burning in because that is the resource they're mostly concerned with.
Did you want to say one more? You look like you were going to.
Yeah, so the issue is really about the trade-offs between the timing and amount, right? So to treat the fuels, you have to have this chronic background emissions every year from the prescribed fires and management fires. But if you're thinking about a projection 50 years out that we're going to have a 200% increase in area burn, which is sort of, you know, order of magnitude that we're looking at in the models that I do, that doesn't mean that it's that much every year, right? It's a relatively smaller subset of years that you're going to have these really huge fires that are going to be putting out most of the emissions under conditions where you can't put them out and where all the smoke is going to sit there if they're coming from the Sierras, you know, either go over to Nevada, in which case we don't care about it, or it'll come here and sit in the Central Valley until the wind changes in the fall. And so you have a lot of populations that are going to be impacted very directly by really high levels of pollution, and that's the trade-off. But, you know, over a period of time that's where you can say, we didn't cause this, it just happened, right? Versus the annual annoyance of the treatment smoke.
Well, one of the problems we have, obviously, is our suppression of wildfires. I mean, we have, like, the Sobranos fire that's burning now in the Big Sur area. And they just said this week, I think it was the $200 million cost, firefighting cost, which is, like, the highest on record. So why aren't we, and we're spending 52% of the Forest Service budget suppressing fires, why aren't we taking that money and using it to do prescribed burning and to do these sort of treatments? I don't know why I'm looking at Hugh.
I can't really speak for the agency on those kinds of matters, but I can tell you that there are obviously, and these guys have all alluded to them, there are all sorts of political pressures involved when you're a federal agency, and what you want to do isn't necessarily what you get to do very often. But I think that, you know, if you look at the history of fire management in the U.S., I mean, it's been more than 40 years now since we transitioned in all the federal agencies from full-on policy of we put everything out by, you know, whatever. The Forest Service had a 10 a.m. rule, right? But it's been more than 40 years since we moved from that to what we call fire management. And, I mean, it's fire science is not a new science anymore. You know what I mean? 20 years ago or 30 years ago, it was a novel thing. Heck, we've known a lot of stuff for 40 or 50 years, and so the problem has been evident since then. And that gives you a feeling for how difficult it is to deal with from the political side, the logistical side, the financial side, just the risk side in general, for an agency like the Forest Service, which is a multiple-use agency. You know, one of the nice things for the Park Service is they have a little bit more of a coherent, like, we are here to conserve these landscapes and this is how we're going to do it. Forest Service, you're having to produce a lot of different things for a lot of different people from a lot of different acres, you know, and so... And we run a lot of checkerboard landscapes, which is a nightmare in terms of management for this, you know, thinking about fire in particular, which tends not to respect boundaries very well. So it's not like we don't know what the problem is. I think that, and this is coming from me, this isn't obviously coming from the agency necessarily, but I personally think we are in a very critical juncture right now. I'm very concerned personally about the sustainability of forests in California, at least the kind of forests that we know. I think Southern California is the prow of the boat in this stuff. John's been talking about the chaparral fire regime down there. There are sky islands of forest down there, too, that act very similarly to the forests in Northern California with respect to just basic ecological processes, fire, et cetera. And they are in big trouble. They're in really, really big trouble. They've had major mortality events. There's huge ozone pollution going in there. You've got a little bit of acid rain happening in those systems, a lot of overuse. They've had the same legacy of fire suppression and these little thumbprints of forests, you know, San Gabriel's, San Gorgonio's, San Jacinto's, for example. And there's a lot of invasive species in these systems, including some that are killing a lot of trees really, really fast. And I can't tell people what the answer is there. I could tell you if no one lived within 100 miles of those places, I can tell you what the answer is, and it would be to start letting fires burn again in those systems. It would look ugly for a while, but after a while it would solve itself. That answer isn't possible in a lot of places that we manage. I will tell you this, that right now we've got three new forest plans. I don't know if you guys know this, but basically about every 15 to 20 years or so, the Forest Service has to develop a new management plan, right, for any landscape, national forest, national grassland that it manages. And we're in the throes of sort of doing a new update on a bunch of plans in the U.S., and three of them are happening in the southern Sierra Nevada. And to me, one of the real, real novel positive outcomes of this 30 or 40 years of watching things kind of start to unravel in the Sierra Nevada is where those plans are going. And they have designated, boy, I think it's more than half of the landscape on the Inyo, Sequoia, and Sierra National Forest for managed fire use, which is a really big deal. It's going to require some big changes in the way that we think about how fires work on landscapes, et cetera. Now, that said, now all of a sudden, over the course of the last 2 years, 3 years, we've had a major mortality event in Southern California, which just makes you want to cry and at least throw your hands up in the air. And I don't know if you folks have been down to Sequoia Kings Canyon or the mountains above Porterville or anywhere from Yosemite or south, but you should go down there and look at it because it'll blow your mind. I mean, John lives right in the middle of this stuff, and Tony's very close to it as well. And we haven't seen it in this part of the state quite as badly. If you drive up Highway 50 very often, you'll notice every time you go a few more patches of red that are growing and growing a little bit more. And by the time, if we get another dry year, that's going to look like Yosemite does now. Anyway, that's created a massive conundrum for us because now there are whole watersheds where 70 to 80% of the pines are all dead, independent of the size. And the question becomes now, what in God's name do we do with this? Because there's no way you can log those things out of there, not only because it's logistically impossible, but because there are no sawmills left in California to deal with the stuff. So where would it even go, and who would even pay for it to happen? And what are the impacts on the critters that we're managing for? A lot of our management, for better or for worse, is driven by species that are adapted to old-growth habitats like spotted owl, goshawk, California fisher. What are the impacts that this mortality is having on them? That's still an open question, but I think we all know the answer to it. So I think that we are, this is a really critical time, and I can tell you that there is not a single obvious, clear, and correct answer to solving this in any given landscape, and it's likely going to be a compartmentalized thing where we're working with society, with partners, with other adjacent landowners to figure out what we do where.
To go back to your original question about, you know, the funding issue, there is a move.
Are you suggesting I didn't answer the original question?
No. I think it's a great change of direction that we need to come back to, but I just wanted to mention that currently the way wildfire funding is allocated is on an annual basis. There's funds that go towards recreation management, that go towards fuels, hazardous fuels reduction, that go to a whole host of activities on federal lands that every year are swept or borrowed or stolen to fight fires because we have to put out the fires. We have emergencies every year. Even though we know they happen every year, they're still emergencies. And all the money that is going towards more proactive work to prevent fires by doing fuels reduction, by doing prescribed burning, by taking care of campgrounds and all of those things, all of that, most of that funding is swept into this fire suppression fund and spent on putting out these conflagrations, and that percentage is increasing every year, has been shown in numerous studies. There's a bill before Congress, we've been working on this for a couple of years now, my organization, the Nature Conservancy, along with others, the Westerman Bill. It's the Wildfire Disaster Funding Act, and it is designed to treat wildfires like all the other major disasters we know are likely to happen, but we don't know exactly when or where. We have a fund built up to take care of hurricanes and floods, and we spend money to take care of those emergencies outside of the preventive work. Now, that being said, the way Congress operates right now, everyone wants to put their favorite little piece attached to that bill, so it hasn't been successful in moving through as a clean budget reform measure. It's had they've added some other things to it that make it less attractive to our colleagues on the left or colleagues on the right, and so it's been stalled out in Congress. So we're hoping that, you know, eventually that this will go through, because I agree with you, we are at an important juncture. We need to, just as we've tried to do with health care reform and think more preventively, do the same thing with natural disasters like wildfire and put more money into prevention rather than trying to clean up the mess afterwards. There's a study that we did with the Forest Service and the Sierra Nevada Conservancy 2 years ago that analyzed the costs of acting proactively and compared it to cleaning up the mess afterwards in the McColumney River watershed, which is the watershed southeast of here that provides most of the water for the East Bay communities of Oakland and Berkeley. Looking at if we do treatments in that area, how does that compare to costs of cleaning up and losses from a wildfire? And it's about 2 to 3 times less expensive to do that proactive work than it is to clean up the mess. So that's a pretty important piece, because not many other analyses have been done along those same lines. And even though we have that evidence, obviously we're reluctant to act in preventive measures. But still, I think it's an important piece for the public to get a better handle on, is that we can save ourselves, because we're the ones who pay the cost of cleaning up these messes. And we need to treat fires more like how we treat floods and hurricanes, and also figure out how to reduce our risk collectively as a culture for those repetitive risks like we have in flood zones, and discourage or maybe incentivize building outside of those hazard zones that are most likely to burn up with the fires that we know are going to occur.
I'm going to stop there, because even though I have a ton more questions, we want to get to yours as well. So we don't have a roaming microphone, but if everybody can just, first of all, journalists, SEJ members get to ask questions first. Please say your name and where you're from, and we will take questions. Craig?
Craig Miller from QQED. Some of you guys know me already. Going back to the climate question, you know, we know that nighttime temperatures are rising faster than daytime temperatures. In the last couple of years up in Lake County, you know, the firefighters, even the veterans, have been talking about how the fire wasn't laying down at night as they used to do. Can any of you speak to kind of how fire behavior is changing because of the climate or other effects?
So I don't have metrics for climate behavior.
Can you repeat the question?
So he's asking if what we know about the change in fire behavior. And I said I don't have metrics for changes in fire behavior over time. But if you think about the climate angle, even in the wet years, on average you're warmer than you would have been without climate change. So you're always evaporating more water. It means you're retaining less in the ecosystem. And then when you have a drought like we've had, if it's warmer during the drought, that makes it more severe. But you also have the fact that you've retained less water from the previous years of precipitation as well, because of the increased evaporation and transpiration. So we're just drying it out. If you look at, I've made some figures that show decade by decade how much drying there's been over on average over the decade. And if you go back 4 decades, you know, you'd see a pattern like, well, we had some big El Niños, La Niñas, so you have a sort of a wet part and a dry part, and then it kind of averages out. But the last 2 decades have been just widespread, intensifying, drying over the whole West without any of that characteristic north south dipole like you'd get with an El Nino or something like that. And it looks just like the climate change signature that you see from the IPCC projections for the Southwest. And so I think that is really driving the fire behavior, but I don't think we have a good handle on exactly to what degree.
Thanks. Yeah. So it just, I would just say again, and I think I'm building off of some of the things that John was talking about, is that the fires that you related, Craig, or referred to were chaparral fires for the most part in Lake County. And what struck me about those, and first of all, you've got to remember that any time that any reporter asks whatever firefighter they can get to talk to them about that firefighter is going to say it's the whip-dangin'est fire they ever seen. So don't forget that, okay? Because I see that every report, I see the fastest thing we've ever seen ever. It's burning everything up. You're like, okay, sure. So, and sometimes it is. I'm not saying, but sometimes it ain't, you know? And so, so the Lake County fires, in my opinion, and John might have an opinion on this too, they reminded me a lot of Southern California fires. The way they burned, who they burned, what they burned, how they acted, real fast, burned well into the evenings, burned lots of homes down. And we haven't had anything like that around the Bay Area since really the Oakland Hills fire. It's been a while. Southern California deals with this every single year, in some cases on massive scale and some not. So Lake County's gotten hit last two summers. It's like, wow. At any rate, a lot of homes getting built out there in the chaparral, and that's a big part of the problem, you know. So, but it's important to note, too, that I think that, as John noted, I don't think that we can say with great certainty that the way fires burn in chaparrals changed a whole ton. John noted that because of the drying and the mortality of shrubs, that there may be some more ember cast. Fires are growing a little bit faster, so you're getting more big fires, which is a problem for a variety of reasons. But I think the big change has been in forest types, but only in certain kinds of forest types. And so another thing that always consternates all of us here at the table and elsewhere is that, you know, the minute you catch people's attention, then they're immediately thinking that, you know, the problem in one ecosystem type is the problem in all ecosystem types. And that's clearly not the case. There are some great publications out there that do a really nice job of differentiating among what Tony was referring to as sort of the climate-limited systems, the ones that almost always have enough fuel, but it's usually too wet to burn, versus the fuels limited systems where they were burnt. It's always dry enough to burn. And the question is, do you have enough fuel in the system to even carry a fire? And there's a great gradation of that. And California, as John noted, is a big state. And so you can go from coastal forests in the Klamath, you know, and some of the wet forests up there that probably didn't see really all that much fire, and there's not much in the way of lightning ignition in a lot of those. You grade into kind of mixed conifer forests where you're more into that fuel-limited stuff, into the Sierra Nevada, where there's no question that fires are burning hotter now than they did historically by all credible measures, no question. And this goes well into the southwestern U.S. You see it in Arizona, you see it in New Mexico, you see it in the southern Rockies as well. But then you end up down in Southern California, and it's kind of a whole different scene. And these things always burned in nuclear fashion, and what they're lacking is ignitions, and we've filled that gap now, and there are plenty of ignitions. So anyway, I would suggest that you just need to be a little careful, but actually that's not what your job is. Your job is to get people to read it, right? So I'm not sure. But anyway, you know, when the firefighters are telling you it's the hottest thing they've ever seen, you might want to ask seven or eight others just to find out if they think the same thing.
Just to add a couple things quickly on your question on novel observations, because I talked to firefighters. I've been on fire line with firefighters and prescribed burning. You have a book called the Fireline Book, and it gives you some tables for predicting fire behavior given environmental conditions and the vegetation type you're working in, because different veg types, as Hugh has mentioned, behave very differently. We've tried to impress upon you here. So the tables have been revised because of there's changes that are occurring that have not been observed before. And you hear that from firefighters. They'll say, I've never seen spotting 3 miles out. My table says it'll go up to 2 miles out under given conditions, but we're seeing this is the 2011 Wallow fire, which I moved from Arizona 3 years ago to move here. And that fire kind of pushed me out the door. That was it. We saw another eighth of the ponderosa pine forest in Arizona go up over a matter of a couple of weeks. So you also hear about fire whirls, fire behavior, that is things they've never seen before. You're never sure if that's just because they're, you know, new, but you hear from older firefighters too, say, I've never seen, like on the Las Conchas fire in New Mexico, I think that was also 2011. There's some these big fire whirls that go way up into the sky, and they're pretty dramatic. And people talk about anecdotal evidence of, I've never seen one act like that. The other thing is with heating and drying, as we talked about with the low moisture, you have live fuel moisture that is, these trees should be dead, but they're still alive. They have such, you know, typically you have 200 to 250% live fuel moisture, but under these deep droughts with high temperatures, you have live fuel moisture that is so low that the trees are exploding, and so you do see some behavior that's pretty extreme as a result of those types of conditions.
Let's take another question. Michael.
Hi, Michael Coatesman, Center for Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado Boulder. And getting back to the bill that kind of seems to be perennially before Congress to change the way we fund firefighting, you know, one criticism of that bill has been that wildfires are a different kind of disaster than, say, hurricanes, which we don't get every year. We get lots of wildfires every year. And you've probably all heard the criticism of this idea of the fire industrial complex and worried that if we create an emergency funding bill like that with some 60% of the more than $3 billion we spend on wildfire going to the private sector, it's going to be a gold rush for every fire to be treated as a disaster and for us to actually invest far more in suppression when most fire ecologists are saying we need to be a lot more targeted about suppression and work on it. Communities and maybe let more fires that are remote burn. So is that a concern to you all with this bill? And if so, how do we put the, you know, how can we put together a bill like that that isn't going to continue to throw, you know, as some firefighters say, continue to pour dollars on the fires to try to put them out?
Maybe you can answer your own question for us and we can nod or shake our head or something. I was just going to say that when you said that there's lots and lots of fires, there are way more earthquakes than there are fires. I mean, the Bay Area has about 15 or 20 of them a day, right? And most of them aren't disasters. So there's got to be some sort of human outcome, right, is kind of the issue. And I guess you'd have to develop some metric or some way of by which people could determine whether or not it's really a disaster or not. You know what I mean? But I don't have the answer for that. But I know what you're saying. I mean, it's a difficult issue.
The big picture is just that the suppression budget has not kept up with the number and size of the fires. So it's always stealing more and more from other activities. And regardless of, you can shape the incentives in a lot of different ways with the kind of legislation that you impose. But the real critical issue is the amount of money, right? If you're going to fight that many fires, you need a certain amount of money to do it. And if you're always looking at what happened the last 5 years or the last 10 years to set your budget going forward, you're always behind the curve.
Yeah, I think, the Faustian bargain there is basically that you're stealing this money it's getting pulled from a lot of different programs, but I think the one that's the most ironic, obviously, is one of the first places it comes from. Well, it's going to come from within the fire budget where they can do that first, and the rest of what's in the fire budget is the preventative stuff. Yeah, I mean that's the thing that just really drives us all nuts. I just wanted to note too that 50%, you know, we're talking about allocated budget towards fire, basically all fire management sectors, right? And the suppression costs themselves are often funded out of other things, depending on what kind of where we are in the year and what year it is. But if you go to Southern California, the forests down there spend over 70% of their budget on fire-related things. It's like 70 to 75 is the typical for the forest, Southern California forest, which is the highest in the nation.
Yeah, I'll just quickly say I agree that there are some issues to work out, but we need to get to the point of guarding that proactive money. I think the details can be worked out as far as, you know, we do have a fire industrial complex, but there's also a group of good scientists and fire practitioners who can weigh in on that and help figure out, okay, this is potentially beneficial versus this is a disaster in the making, given the drought severity index and the place, the vegetation where it is, the resources at risk. There's ways that we can manage the processing of the decision matrix on whether or not we proceed with suppression or management. So your point is well taken. We need to get to the position where we can actually hammer out the details rather than just get stopped.
Back.
I'm Let me ask a question about portability and reporting. Whenever a fire breaks out, instantly one of the questions goes up, well, who is responsible? Is it, you know, a camper or a hunter or whatever? And I recall reading a paper by John many years ago that just charted population versus fire incidents, and there was a very nice match. So is it a mistake to focus on individual culpability with fire?
And can you repeat the question for me?
I'm not sure that's my area of expertise. I would say that I think there are very good reasons to do it, and that is because our worst fires very often are arson-ignited fires. And the reason they're the worst is arsons generally pick the worst fire weather conditions to start fires. And certainly the judicial system has gotten really severe in terms of dealing with arson-ignited fires. We had a couple cases in Southern California where arsons got the death penalty for igniting fires, which is rather severe. These are fires where people died and the arson was held accountable for it. I don't know if they're going to be upheld in terms of appeal, although the first round of appeals they were. There is a lot of value in sorting out the ignition causes and big fire events, and we're doing this now for the last 100 years of records, looking at what are the causes of the biggest and worst fires. And in general, they've actually always been arson is one of the big ones, motorized equipment is another big one, and power lines. This is statewide. Well, we can see it in all the parts of the state, that arson has been a big cause in all parts of the state. Now, it's changed over time. Electrical or equipment ignited fires has actually gone up. It wasn't real big in the early part of this last century, but it started going up in the 70s. What's interesting is it's peaked in about the 90s, and now it's going down, and so somebody is doing something. It does suggest that fire prevention is probably an important avenue to put more effort into, and preventing ignitions, not necessarily the money that Hugh was talking about in terms of fire prevention towards vegetation manipulation, but prevention of ignitions. I think those are avenues for some improvement in fire situation.
George?
Proper temporal and spatial scale to view these things. What I'm getting at is, if you compare fires to 40 years ago or something like that, compared to maybe going back 500 or 1,000 years, for example, the medieval warming period, there were substantial large fires and apparently burning in many parts of the West. Where the point I'm getting at is, if you go back to the most recent climate was a little wetter and moister versus comparing today's climate with past climate similarly, did we experience similar kinds of consequences in terms of fires?
Yeah, so when I'm doing the assessments for the states, so we're in the middle of the fourth assessment for California now for climate change impacts and vulnerability. And we produce a bunch of fire simulations around different scenarios for analyzing impacts on different sectors like energy infrastructure, insurance markets, things like that. And we specifically use recent decades, but not too far back, as our reference point for estimating the models. And that's because what we want to know is, how does the sort of coupled human natural system that we operate right now, how is it going to change incrementally in the coming decades? And that's all anybody here who's managing the resource really cares about in the short term, right? Is how is what we know today going to change in the near future? And how can we manage around that trajectory.
I might just make one other point about that. If we've been looking at historical data in the state over the last 100 years, and in both state lands as well as, or state protected lands as well as federal lands, the peak in fire activity, one of the highest peaks was in the 1920s. And then it went down over some period of time. If you look climatically, the 1920s was a very severe drought. And just like our peaks today are during severe droughts. One thing, though, that is different is temperatures were not abnormally high during that period of time, suggesting that maybe the climatic factors are changing over time in terms of their importance. But one of the big problems in trying to parse out climate and all this is a lot of things have changed over that period of time. For example, people ignited fires much more freely during the 1920s. In fact, the agencies didn't even record arson-ignited fires. They were called incendiary fires because people who started fires, it was not necessarily considered to be against the law. And so people would ignite fires, and that would be the listed cause. It wasn't until like the 60s or 70s that they stopped recording incendiary fires and called them arson, because by then it was clear that this was not something people should be doing. But then there's the whole question of fire suppression and the changes in the fuels. And so it's really hard to parse climate out when you have all these other things going on.
So that's actually a really good question, and it gets into sort of geological timescales and biogeography and all these things. But I think it also gets at the human value systems kind of that we're working with. And I think that, so probably some of you have heard this before, but I'm a geologist by training originally, and Stephen Jay Gould was always a big hero of mine, paleontologist really. And he always took this stance when he would be asked about sort of the new extinction that's being driven by humans. And he said, well, you know, if you look back in the past, there were 7 or 8 or 9 of these things in the past, and they were catastrophic, and huge numbers of critters went extinct and life forms went away, and maybe it was due to an asteroid or the Plano or whatever, the Pangaea and the ice caps and all this stuff. And he would just sort of muse on that. He'd say, you know, the planet survives this stuff. And people would just go crazy over there, like, wait a minute, you know, because he's clearly an environmentalist. And, so his point was just simply that, look, every time we've had an extinction, the planet's still there. The life force is still there, and there's millions of years for even crazier, wilder things to evolve. And he says it's really cool if, like a person like me, because those extinctions create this blank slate, and then even wilder things come out of it. And so, yeah, no, exactly. I just wanted to note that that is a viewpoint that you can take. You can have that viewpoint, and we are inseparable from the environment that we live in, and the environment and the way we perceive it is inseparable from the way that we manage it, right? So a lot of it comes down to, well, the Park Service is in the throes of a real cultural shift now, or that's not the right word. The way they think about what they manage and how they do it is they're having some real issues with, like, well, how do we do all this stuff? And there's some really great stuff that's come out from this thinking process they're involved in right now, which is we thought our job was just to simply grab these places we were given and keep them like this forever. And they are not going to be like that forever. And they don't have a whole lot of tools, actually, that they can use to help maybe try to keep it at least a little bit like it was, because people kind of like it the way it was. So anyway, George, I think you know what I'm getting at. It's just that a lot of this, and heck, as a result, a lot of the debates that we have and a lot of the, you know, teeth gnashing and fist swinging that we get into comes down to how we perceive the value of the landscapes. And I think that you can't get away from the fact that people use wood. People have homes in the woods. People like to get water. People like shade, or they don't, or whatever, you know, or they like sheep, or they don't. And that's fine. And those kind of things, and this is kind of what's challenging but also sort of somewhat interesting about the situation that we're in always constantly as humans, is that it requires a lot of debate and a lot of soul searching about these things, and I don't think there are any right answers.
Yeah, the point I was trying to get at is just that there's the temporal scale that you use and the spatial scale affects how you perceive these things. And yep.
That's absolutely right.
I'm going to take one more question here. You've been waiting.
I just had a quick question for the forested landscape. My name's Al Burton from the Seattle Times. This has come up, and some of the Forest Service folks have maintained this from their experiences. And I just wonder if you all feel like this is borne out at all, because it is another factor. It's basically a safety thing. Some of the Forest Service people in Washington State on the east side have argued that getting prescribed fire in is good for, yes, reducing fire risk, all that, but it also gives firefighters a safer place to put a line, make an entry, to basically a safer place to make a stand when the fires break out in the summer. And, you know, we just lost three young firefighters last year. So it's really right there in people's minds. So I just wondered from your perspective, anyone who's way in here, whether you think there is a benefit prescribed fire in terms of safety on the fire line when another type, when a summer fire breaks out.
I'll answer back on. I think that there's a couple of different things we can do here. One is prescribed fires is one way to reduce fuels. Mechanical harvest or vegetation manipulation or other ways. And we saw a really good example of this. I'll go back to the Wallow Fire in eastern Arizona that I had direct experience with. We thought that was going to take out the towns of Alpine and Nutrioso. And they'd done a lot of work in the urban interface. They hadn't been thinning, but they hadn't done a lot of the burning, the prescribed burning, to follow on the mechanical harvest. The fire front came through, and we were just, in pins and needles to see what would happen to those towns. They evacuated. The fire was going through the canopies for 5-6 miles in these unprecedented fire behavior activities that, just horrible, horrendous cataclysm, and got into those treatment areas and moved to the ground just like they're supposed to, and moved across the surface. The firefighters were able to get in and do suppression activities, reduce the homes loss. Those forests that they had treated because of this flaming front and this heat pulse that came through killed a lot of those trees. I mean, this is broad generalizations across miles, but these towns of Nutrioso and Greer and Alpine were spared because of the mechanical harvest activities that they had done. Now, they hadn't cleaned up everything. They hadn't gotten it perfect. So, you could say that they lost the battle for the forest, but they saved the communities. They were able to actually do suppression activities effectively. There's one anecdotal piece, and it's been documented with some studies. But I think that there's only a few things that we can do. We can either get the heck out of the way, and that's not really an option because people are already living so interdigitated with this flammable vegetation. We've heard from the climate modelers that we're likely to see more and more of this. But the other thing is to do some work in small areas that we can afford and try to make a difference. And putting fire back on the ground is part of that. And a really important from an ecological standpoint in building resilience that is long-lasting.
I might just add one thing related to that. In general, I think the point is probably well taken that reducing fuels is going to increase firefighters' safety. But there are trade-offs depending on, what type of fuel you produce. And a good illustration of this, I can't remember the name of the fire. Hugh probably remembers it. But Google fire August 6, 1949. One of the worst fire losses. 13 firefighters died. And this was in a grass fire. And one of the trade-offs is
you're talking about the Mann Gulch fire?
Yeah, the Mann Gulch fire, yeah. Right. Grass generally is thought of as being a less hazardous fuel, but the problem with grass is fires move really fast through grass fires, and these firefighters, all but one, I guess, tried to outrun it, and they didn't succeed. So just because you change from heavy fuels to light fuels is not necessarily a guarantee that you're going to produce safer conditions.
I'm going to have to wrap it up there.
Hold on. I got to tell you something. I grew up right by Mann Gulch, and that actually at the same time is a great example of how a prescribed fire lit on site saved that guy's life. He had a matchbook on him, lit the grass off, burned around him, and that's why he lived. So it's kind of a wild little microcosm.
One
of, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Let's thank our panelists for coming. Thank you.